we notice so many faces today that were not present yesterday, so we would repeat the message of love and greetings from the Chicago Ecclesia to the friends gathered here. The hymn we just sang so beautifully describes the Lord's faithful on this side of the veil, does it not? How often you've reflected upon these words as you sung them, and then thought of your own experiences and the experiences of your brethren, and noticed how well they fit in to the way the Lord looks upon us and the way the world looks upon us as we endeavor to serve our Master and to walk in His footsteps. Names in the Bible are usually given because of certain significant circumstances attached to the individual at the time they are born, or the Lord forcing the experiences under which they will go. They are named accordingly. And so often we get a blessing of looking in the back of our Bibles to the concordance, the index of proper names, and there we notice these different Old Testament and New Testament names, and we endeavor to derive the meaning of the name and get a blessing thereby, noticing just why this name was given to this individual or that one. But sometimes we wonder from what source these men who've put these concordances together, they have received their information, if directly the Scripture doesn't state the reason why someone was named as they were. But nevertheless, because we lack any more knowledge than they give us in the concordance, why, we're satisfied to take the interpretation given by these and try to see how it fits in with the Scripture. This happens to be the occasion when we look at the first family. The first family that dwelt upon this earth. Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel are brought to our attention so forcibly right in the very beginning of man's history here upon earth. Now, the name Abel was given to this young man, and we are told that the meaning of this name has the thought of breath or vapor or transitoriness. Another gives us as interpretation a metal. Now, whether his life, because his life was so short that they attached the meaning to this name later, or whether it was really intended for that purpose, we don't know, but we can see in his life that this meaning of the name Abel attached itself properly. If we wish to take the first three meanings, breath, vapor, and transitoriness, they fit. His name, Abel, was well given to this young man. His life was so short, was it not? Just like a breath. Or as James in his epistle, the 4th chapter and the 14th verse puts it, whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow, what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time, and then it vanishes away. James describes our present life very accurately, does he not? It's like a little vapor. You've seen some vapor come up from some pipe somewhere, and you see it for a second, and then it disappears. And James says that that is just like our present life. And how true that was of Abel. He appeared on the scene for just a short while, and then he was gone. It was very transitory. Or the name metal would also, the meaning metal would also fit into his name. You can look upon a meadow in its greenness, foliage so bright and fresh because of the warm weather and the sun. But when the skies withhold their rain for a few weeks and the sun gets good and hot, it just burns it up and dries it up and the greenness of it is gone. In so short a time, that which was so luxuriant with green is over with. All burnt up and brown. It's gone. And so, even with this interpretation, it seems to fit in with Abel's experiences. Now Cain, his name, they tell us, means possession. He was the firstborn of Adam and Eve. And you remember what Eve said when Cain was born? She says, I have gotten a man from the Lord. She was so happy that she received a man from the Lord. And reflecting on these statements that the Lord made to the serpent, that the seed of the woman would bruise the serpent's head, she probably thought that this was the man, this was the seed whom the Lord would use to crush the serpent's head and bestow revenge upon him for the damage that was done to that family when they were driven out of the Garden of Eden. So she was so happy. I have gotten a man from the Lord. Yes, and Cain, meaning possession. She was so happy that she received this man from the Lord. He was the firstborn, you see. And therefore, she was so happy that the Lord had given her this man. And so the scriptures go on to tell us that Abel became a shepherd. Cain, a tiller of the soil. And you remember how they brought their offerings to the Lord as a sacrifice. Cain brought of the fruit of the ground and offered it upon his altar. And Abel, the account tells us, brought a firstling from the flock with all the fat thereof. Even that phrase is thrown in and it's meaningful. He brought in the firstling of the flock with the fat thereof. How often you've reflected on this account that Cain, in so early a period of man's history, could have become a murderer of his brother Abel. And often we've thought over in our minds, how could such noble parents as Adam and Eve, just a step away from perfection. That's all they were when they brought forth their firstborn. Just a step away from perfection. How could they have brought forth a son with such an evil disposition as Cain? Well, it has been suggested, and it sounds reasonable to us, that evidently Cain was birthmarked with selfishness by his mother Eve. During the period of gestation, as she probably murmured in her heart, respecting the loss of her Edenic home, and she selfishly coveted to be returned to it again. And probably with those thoughts running through her mind, before Cain was brought forth, that child was birthmarked accordingly. But Abel was born a little later. And it has been suggested that doubtless by that time, the parents had somewhat mellowed in their heart and were reconciled to the fate that was their lot when they were driven out of the garden. And therefore, with that frame of mind, a little mellowness through time and experience, that Abel was brought forth with a different disposition than his older brother Cain. And you remember their respective offerings and how the Lord manifested his acceptance of Abel's sacrifice, and he refused or did not accept Cain's. Yes. And in the lives of certain men in the Bible, and especially these two, as we recall and see how they reacted to certain experiences and incidents in their lives, along certain fixed lines, which seem to picture forth, on a small scale, larger events that would be enacted a little bit later. When Cain's sacrifice was not acceptable, his countenance fell, and he saw that his younger brother was acceptable to the Lord. He became jealous. And the Lord could read his heart. And the Lord warned him that sin lies at the door of your heart, Cain, but you can resist it. Don't open that door or else he'll jump in and overcome you. But according to the account, Cain did not take heed to this warning. He opened the door of his heart, and sin leaped right in and took hold of him, and he slew his brother Abel. Yes, he thought that by his own works he would be acceptable to God, by the work of his own hands, whereas Abel, all he could bring was, well, the natural increase of the flock. He couldn't increase the number of those sheep. It was as the Lord gave the increase and blessed him through natural reaction amongst the animals that he was prospering. But Cain had to work with his own hands, with his own strength, to produce the fruit of the soil. And so we recall how in the first advent of Jesus, the Jewish leaders, Israel especially, as reflected in their leaders, the scribes and the Pharisees, they thought that they could be justified by their own works under the law. Whereas Jesus, the true Lamb of God, because of his perfection, his sinlessness, and his perfection was supplied by God, you see. Jesus didn't work for his perfection. It was given to him by God. His righteousness supplied by the Creator. Whereas the religious leaders of the day, they thought that they could justify themselves by the works, their works, under the law arrangements. And when they saw how Jesus was acceptable to the Lord, how the law wrought miracles through him, yes, and Jesus sacrificed how it was acceptable, just like Abel's. He brought that firstling of the sheep with the fat thereof, and it burned furiously. And so Jesus' sacrifice was the same. Yes, with much zeal, as the Scriptures tell us, that the zeal of the Lord's house hath consumed him. And so they saw how he was winning the people. They said, look, the whole world has gone after him. We've got to do something about this man. And so they did. Just like Cain, so Abel's sacrifice was acceptable, and his wasn't. So these two, as they saw Jesus gaining in popularity, and theirs waning, they began to think, they began to make plans to murder Jesus. Yes? You remember on one occasion, John 12:17-19, the people, therefore, that was with him when he called Lazarus out of his grave and raised him from the dead, bear record. For this cause the people also met him, for that they heard that he had done this miracle. The Pharisees, therefore, said among themselves, perceive ye how he prevail nothing? Behold, the world is gone after him. Yes, and continuously plotting his death, when opportunity offered itself, like Cain slew Abel, so they rose up and they slew the Master, the Lamb of God, who was offered for the sins of the world. Just like back there, if Cain would have recognized the Lord's arrangement and had heeded the warning, why, and if he were humble enough, why, he would have had an exchange with his brother, with their produce, and would have said, well, the Lord seemingly has accepted your sacrifice, and that's the type he wants. Well, let us have an exchange, and let me have one of your lambs so I could also offer acceptably to the Lord. But no, Cain lacked humility, you see. After all, was he not the firstborn of the family? And was he not the heir of the family? Was he not the promised seed that was to come? Yes. He evidently knew from his mother the statement that was made in the Garden of Eden, that the seed of that woman would crush the serpent's head, and was he not the first one that was born in the family? Was he not the seed? And so instead of humility, pride took over in his life. It was so with these religious leaders of Jesus' day. Instead of accepting him as the Messiah, the sent of God, and recognizing God's wonderful works through him, and coming to him and asking him the way of salvation. No, because of pride. Because of lack of humility. They too asked Cain, instead of approaching the Lord in the proper way, they took the path of death, of sin, of pride, and they slew the master. In the account, after Cain had slain Abel, if you read it, you notice that the Lord did not slay Cain for murdering his brother. Though subsequently, when the law was given to Israel, we recall the arrangement, a life for a life. If someone murdered an individual, why, his life was required of him. But in this instance, it wasn't so. The Lord did not require the life of Cain for the life of his brother Abel. And we wonder why. Nevertheless, Cain was punished, but he was not put to death. Was it not so with the nation of Israel, as represented in their leaders, because they refused the Messiah and slew him? The Lord could have destroyed that nation, could he not? For their national sin? But no, instead he did not destroy them, but punishments were given instead. In fact, the scriptures reveal to us in Genesis 4:15 that the Lord would protect Cain from being murdered for this crime. Isn't that an odd incident, friends, and turn of events? We read, "And the Lord said unto him, Therefore whoever slayeth Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord set a mark upon Cain, lest any finding him should kill him." It seemed like the Lord was protecting this man, you see, instead of letting him go and suffer the consequences of his crime. Once again, the Lord was drawing us a picture of something which would take place on a larger scale. Yes, and so it was with the nation of Israel. Instead of destroying them, the Lord permitted the punishments to come upon them, as foretold in Leviticus 26th chapter and Deuteronomy the 30th chapter. Jeremiah, as the Lord's mouthpiece, tells us this. The Lord here is speaking to Israel, the disobedient people. "For I am with thee, saith the Lord, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all nations, whither I have scattered thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee, but I will correct thee in measure, and I will not leave thee altogether punished." Yes. Though the Lord make a full end of all nations, whether he had scattered Israel, he would not make a full end of that nation. No. Nevertheless, they were to be punished for their national sin. And they were. All those centuries after they were scattered and peeled throughout all of the European nations into Asia and Africa, they were driven around from pillar to post, a marked people suffering the punishments that the law required of them for their disobedience to their covenant obligation with the Lord. Yes, that was part of the punishment which came upon that people for their slaying of the Messiah, the final test which the Lord permitted to come upon them as a people. You notice the account in Genesis 4 said that the Lord set a mark upon Cain. Yes, he designated him in some way, identified him. We don't know just what that mark was. But nevertheless, the account tells us that the Lord set a mark upon Cain, lest any finding him should kill him. They would know that that's Cain, and the Lord would require vengeance sevenfold of anyone who would slay him. And so we find that the nation of Israel as well was marked by the Lord. Their experiences under the law marked them. How did the law mark them? Well, by their habits. by their attempting to keep the law to the best of their ability. They are a separated and marked people from all other nations in the world. By all of their habits under the law. Not only their attempt to attain unto righteousness, but even their physical habits mark them as distinct and different from other people. We read of an account in the Dark Ages of Europe when the dark plague, the bubonic plagues, were wiping out hordes of the European population. They tell us that the Jew seemingly was spared in those plagues. And why was it? Their physical habits, the type of food that they ate, and the food that they weren't supposed to eat, their dietary habits, seemingly gave them the resistance in their bodies to keep away the effect of those plagues. And so, while others died by the thousands, the Jew was hardly touched by those plagues. You see, that was one way that the law marked them. And then, you know how, in other ways it marked them. It always kept them a separate and distinct people. The desire to mingle with Gentiles was never in their hearts. Because the law trained them, you see, not to intermarry with Gentiles. Well, of course, that sort of passed away in some measure in later years, especially in our day, this generation. But during those dark ages, they were really a marked and separated people. And then, you know, it seemed like the Lord went a little further than that. He even marked them physically. Even marked them physically. Now, how the Lord did that, we don't know. But nevertheless, even from physical appearance, you could tell an Israelite in any crowd. And that would be generally true. There may be some slight exceptions to the rule, but as a general rule, you'll spot an Israelite in any crowd. Yes, whoever would slay Cain would be punished. And any nation that has attempted to eliminate the Jew, and there have been many, they suffered as a result of that act. And any nation which has favored that downtrodden people to any extent have somehow, some way, been blessed by the Lord. Isn't that odd, friends, how the Lord arranged that? That those who tried to eliminate that people, that would persecute them to the utmost, though the Lord foretold that such would be their lot. If they tried to eliminate that people, they were punished as a result. But any nation which helped them seemingly was blessed for their kindness toward that people. And so we read in Genesis 4:16, and Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod, eastward of Eden. Just a little statement concerning his departure after the crime had been committed and the punishments foretold. But yet we investigate this statement a little bit and we notice that it says that Cain went out from the presence of the Lord. And so Israel too, after their national sin of slaying the Messiah, all favor came to an end 3.5 years after the death of Jesus. Their 70 weeks came to an end, and from then on, they left the presence of the Lord. They were cut off from all favor as a people. Just like Cain, he went out from the presence of the Lord. Then it says, he dwelt in the land of Nod. Name is kind of interesting, isn't it? The name of Nod. You know what that word means? Once again, we have to rely on these commentators of our Bible, and they give us an interesting interpretation. They say it means wandering. Why, how interesting. Why, hasn't the term the wandering Jew been attached to that people ever since they were dispersed from Palestine after the crucifixion of the Master? That is about A.D. 70. Why, of course that has been the title of that people. They've been called the wandering Jew. Why? Driven from pillar to post, from country to country, not permitted to own real estate or property of any kind, they made their living as best they could, merchandising one thing or another, traveling from town to town, trying to eke out a living, wandering Jews. And so Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod, on the east of Eden, on the east part of Eden. You know, when the sun would come up and shine towards Eden, it would first shine upon Cain's dwelling place, you see, because he dwelt on the east of Eden. Whether there would be any meaning attached to this or not, it still fits into a nice picture. When the Son of Righteousness will eventually arise with healing in his beings, and the whole earth is again restored to the Garden of Eden conditions, who will be first in line of the sun's rays to receive the warmth and blessing of the Lord before the whole world is turned back to an Edenic condition? The Jewish people. They'll be first in line. Because of their position in the Lord's arrangement, they'll get the blessings first. And they, therefore, will be the first family on earth to receive restitution blessings from the Lord. Yes, how beautifully this term, nod or wandering, fits this people. But you say, that is all in the past. They're not wandering anymore. They returned to their homeland. And now they are recognized as a nation amongst the family of nations, a member of the UN, and so on. That is true. How glad we are that, in a great measure at least, though not universally true, that this term, wandering, is ceasing to be attached to them as a people. How many brethren who were watching the prophecies rejoiced when in 1948, with the assistance of the President of the United States, those people were recognized as a nation and permitted to dwell in their homeland as theirs for good. Why, there was an indication of prophetic fulfillment, was it not? The fig tree began certainly to blossom and to throw off green leaves, showing signs of life. And how the brethren rejoiced. Another evident sign in fulfillment of Matthew 24 that the Lord was surely present and directing the affairs of that people as he had foretold in so many places and through so many mouthpieces of his. And so, you know, the Jewish people were so happy when this blessed time had come that they could now turn their eyes toward Palestine. After all of their wandering, at last a homeland for them. And there was a song that came up about that time. They sang it quite often on the radio. I never heard it. But others did, and especially some members of my family, and they brought it to my attention. They said, haven't you heard this song that the Jews are singing? And they even interpreted it into the English language, and it sounds so good. I said, well, when you hear it, write it down on a piece of paper. I like to have it for a record. It was a catchy ballad. I don't know whether any of you heard it, but this is the way the words went. It was titled, No More Wandering for Me. Tell me, where can I go? There's no place where I see. Where to go, every door is closed for me. To the left or to the right, it's the same in every land. There's no place where to go, and it's me who should know. Won't you please understand? Now I know where to go, where my folks proudly stand. Let me go to my precious land. No more left, no more right. Lift your head and see the light. I am proud, can't you see? For at last I am free. No more wandering for me. That's the song they were singing. And can't you picture the zeal in the hearts of those Jews as they sang that song? No more wandering for me. You know, some brethren had the privilege of visiting Palestine recently. We spoke to one brother who spent about 35 days in that country. He had an opportunity to mingle with all types of people. And usually he went to the working men, the farmers, the merchants, and so on, the little people. He would ask them their reaction as to how they felt about coming back to their homeland And oh, he says, the joyous response that he received as he noticed their faces lighting up when he asked them the question. He said he remembered one group of men who were building a road, putting up stones and a little wall on the side, you know, and one man picked up a stone and he fondled it so wonderfully in his hand. He says, you see this? He says, when I put this here, he says, I know it's going to stay here. It's mine, he says. This belongs to us. And no one will ever take it away from us again. He was so happy. This stone that he was going to put into that wall or that road, he says, that's going to be for us. This is our homeland, and how glad we are to work here, because this belongs to me. You see, no more wandering for the Jews back in their homeland. And now they tell us there's about 1.75 million of them there. And gradually they're streaming in. A little at a time now. It has not been as much as it was right after the persecutions of Hitler during the last war and after the war ended. Nevertheless, they are still going there. And they're beginning to prosper a little bit. Yes. Oh, they're not yet reached a position where, as the prophet tells us in Ezekiel 38:12, that these nations from the north, especially north of that land in Europe, when they notice their gradual decline and Israel's rising in wealth, prosperity, when they will say, let us go down there and take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn their hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations which have gotten cattle and goods and that dwell in the midst of the land. They're not saying that yet, but that's what it's coming to, friend, you see. Gradually, this will be the turn of events when Israel will begin to prosper and the other nations will begin to feel the pinch of the time of trouble in which they have been found now since 1914. Yes, but this will come to pass. This condition must come to pass because the Lord foretold it, you see. And so we watch the incidents in Palestine carefully. Why? Because there's so much in the Bible that has to say concerning that favored people of the Lord, the first family of the land. Yes, you remember how the prophet foretold how they would begin to be gathered there. That the fishers or Zionist movement would begin to fish after them, to try to tempt them with bait to come back to that land. But not so many came. So the Lord said, well, I'll send hunters, and they'll hunt you out of every hill, out of every crag, out of every rock, out of every cave. They'll find you, and they'll drive you back. Friends, it hasn't been so much in the past now. It's within the reach of even the poorest of our memories, how they were persecuted by the dictators during the last war and previous. And so searching was the experience that any Jew who might have married 4 or 5 generations back with a Gentile, and it seemed like his past was covered up, Hitler's men would go through the birth records and they'd find that Jew 4 and 5 generations before. And if he had any Jewish blood in him, he was picked up, uprooted, and sent to a prison camp. Yes. They thought the people had forgotten their background. It might have been their great-great-grandfather was a Jew, but now they were mixed with all kinds of other nationalities. But they found them. They dug in every hole, every crag, every cave, and they found the Jew, like the Lord foretold. The hunters would get you, and they were driven there, back to their homeland. That was the Lord's arrangement, you see, to drive them back through these hunters. And driven they were, as we can readily see, and we have seen it in our own day. But so many of them are there now, and the stage is being set for the final drama of the ages, which will take place right there in Palestine. Jeremiah 30, the first few verses, begins to describe that condition and that incident. He says, for lo, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will bring again the captivity of my people, Israel and Judah, saith the Lord, I will cause them to return to the land that I gave to their fathers, and they shall possess it. See how beautifully that was fulfilled? Exactly as the Lord foretold through Jeremiah. He would bring them back to that land that he promised to their fathers, and they shall possess it. And so they do. But they don't possess all of it yet, you see. Nevertheless, in measure, they already possess it. It is theirs now, and they will never be driven off of that land again, the scriptures tell us. But, reading down a few verses in Jeremiah, especially the fifth verse, we begin to see a turn of events. Yes, they'll be prospering then, people who have gotten much goods and cattle, and seemingly prospering on every hand. For thus saith the Lord, we have heard a voice of trembling and not of peace. Well, what's happening? Oh, you see, the final incident of the invasion of Gog and Magog begins to have this reaction in that people then. We have heard a voice of trembling, they say, and not of peace. And then the scene comes on and tells us how these enemies shall come like a storm. Quickly, Ezekiel 38:9 describes it such, thou shalt ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands and many people with thee. Then we go back to Jeremiah 30:6-7, and he again begins to describe the plight of that people as they see this horde coming toward them to destroy them as a nation. He says, ask ye now and see whether a man doth travail with child. Have you ever heard of a man travailing with child? Why, of course not. It's physically impossible. Wherefore do I see every man with his hands on his loin, in pain and in fear, as a woman in travail, and all faces are turned into paleness? He says, alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. Think of all the days previous to this. This one will be different than all the others put together. There is none like this one, it says. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble. Yes, that's the incident that the prophet is describing just in the near future. He says, but he shall be saved out of it. Yes, Jacob's trouble comes to Israel not when they're in Europe. We can't designate the hunter arrangement that the Lord permitted to come upon that people to drive them back and say that that was Jacob's trouble. That was the hunter arrangement that Jeremiah foretold about. But Jacob's trouble, it tells us, takes place in their own homeland, after they have been gathered out from many countries and peoples and have returned there and begin to possess the land. That's the time of Jacob's trouble. And so the Lord permits this to come upon them. Why? Oh, as a final test and also a corrective measure. Why? Well, while they're dwelling in peace and prosperity in their own land, and while they look upon the other Gentile powers who then will be sinking more and more into debt, and more troubles will be around them, they may begin to think that this is the time that the Lord has set for us to save all the nations and to lead them from their troubles into prosperity. After all, is not our nation the Messiah? Yes. There is an element in Israel that firmly believes that Messiah is the nation of Israel, who will lead the world out of trouble and chaos into the glorious kingdom foretold by the prophet. And so the Lord will send them this final trial as a corrective measure to prove to them that they, in their present condition, are not ready to lead anyone into a kingdom or unto salvation. No. They, as a nation, are not the Messiah. So the Lord sends Gog and Magog there in this final attempt to erase this people from the face of the earth. Yes, and we know how the outcome will result. God's power through Christ, who will fight for those people like the Lord fought for them in days of old. You remember in their various battles how the Lord used different miracles to defeat the Philistines, the Moabites, or the Amorites, or whoever came against them. Once it was great hail. Another time it was great thunder. And then another time, why, he would have the people fighting against themselves. And so Israel sometimes never lifted a sword. And still their enemies fled before them in utter defeat. And so the Lord tells us that those were just little sample illustrations of the principles he will use and put into practice when these great hosts come up against Israel to try to wipe it out. We read in another place that of this great army that comes up against them, 6/7 of them will never return back from whence they came alive. Only 1/7 will escape. So great will be the slaughter of the enemies of Israel. Yes, and then the scriptures also tell us that this great defeat of these hosts that come up against that people will signal the anarchy which will then break loose throughout the whole world. Ezekiel 38:20-21 tells us, so that the fishes of the sea and the fowls of the heaven and the beasts of the field and all creeping things that creep upon the earth and all the men that are upon the face of the earth shall shake at my presence, and the mountains shall be thrown down. Not literal mountains, friends, but kingdoms shall be thrown down, and the steep places shall fall, and every wall, every method of what men thought would protect them shall fall to the ground. And I will call for a sword against him throughout all my kingdoms, saith the Lord God. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. Yes, that will be the signal arrangement for a general breakdown amongst men when the Lord turns his hand against the enemies of Israel. Isaiah describes this same event, Jacob's trouble, but more briefly. And then he gives us the aftermath. Isaiah 66:15-20. We'll just read this to give you the thought of how Isaiah touches upon the very same thing. He says, for behold, the Lord will come with fire and with chariots like a whirlwind to render his anger with fury and his rebukes with flames of fire. For by fire and by his sword will the Lord plead with all flesh, and the slain of the Lord shall be many. They that sanctify themselves and purify themselves in the garden behind one tree, in the midst eating swine's flesh, and the abominations and the mouse shall be consumed together, saith the Lord. In other words, the Lord is saying this, that in that trouble, those Jews who were in that land but were not living up to their obligations to him under the law, he will see to it that these rebels will be weeded out. They'll be put to death by these who come to invade them. Yes, it says one half of the city will be taken, their women will be ravished, and when it seems like all hope is gone, then the Lord steps in with a mighty hand and turns the tide against the enemies of Israel and saves them out of Jacob's trouble. For the Lord goes on and says, for I know their works. He's watching them now. He sees those who are really putting their trust in him and who are admitting from the heart that it is the Lord who brought them to this land and not by any clever political maneuvers that some think have resulted in their attaining to their homeland. I know their works and their thoughts, and it shall come that I will gather all nations and tongues, and they shall come and see my glory. And I will set a sign among them, and I will send those that escape. Now notice, this 1/7 that escapes the Lord's slaughter that came against Palestine, he says, I will send those who escape unto the nations. To Tarshish, to Pul, to Lud, these different names, to Tubal, to Javan, are all these Old Testament names which have their modern counterparts in our so-called Christian nations. And to the isles afar off. Yes, they'll be sent forward as missionaries, you see, to declare what the Lord did at Palestine. They that have not heard my fame, neither have seen my glory, and they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles. How nice, friend, you see. This remnant that is saved, the Lord uses them as his messengers to go to all the different countries and relate to them of the Lord's mighty works in Palestine. And it goes on. And Rotherham's translation makes it more definite. He says, and then, you see, then, after the trouble is over, he says, then they shall bring all your brethren for an offering unto the Lord out of all nations, upon horses, chariots, in litters, upon mules, upon swift beasts, to my holy mountain Jerusalem, saith the Lord, as the children of Israel bring an offering in a clean vessel unto the house of the Lord. Now here's where some make a mistake. They say, see, this is being fulfilled now. Isn't the Lord bringing them from all nations upon all kinds of and means of transportation? Ships and trains and horses and wagons, whatever way the Jew could escape the punishment of Hitler, he fled towards Palestine. And they say, that was fulfilled then. And so therefore, Jacob's trouble is over. We are now entering into the kingdom itself, and we don't have to wait for the ancient worthies to get here. The Lord will establish the kingdom without them on the basis of this interpretation. But if you follow the context, it shows us that then, after Jacob's trouble is complete, then the Lord will gather all the remnant of all Jews from all nations. Yes, the Lord isn't going to send all of them there before Jacob's trouble. It's not necessary. There'll be a good many of them in other countries when Jacob's trouble takes place. But he says, then, after Jacob's trouble, he'll see to it that all these nations, Gentiles, will send these Jews upon all manner of transportation to Israel. And how do we know that? Well, here's another verification. He'll send them to my holy mountain Jerusalem. Is Palestine now God's holy mountain or kingdom? Is it? Well, if it is, this has been fulfilled. But Palestine, Israelite, Jerusalem, is not yet the Lord's holy mountain. But it will be after the trouble is over and the ancient worthies come on the scene and the new covenant is made with them and with the Israelites, them living. Then Jerusalem will be the holy mountain or kingdom of the Lord. It is not now the holy mountain or kingdom of the Lord. Therefore, this is not yet fulfilled. And then it says, they shall bring the children of Israel as an offering to the Lord in the clean vessel. Yes, notice that the Gentiles now are in harmony with the Lord's arrangement. They'll bring them as an offering to the Lord. Do you think that the nations have been bringing Israel as an offering to the Lord since Hitler's pogroms and persecution? I don't think that they were sending the Israelites there as an offering to the Lord. Of course not. They were trying to destroy that people. But here it says, after Jacob's trouble is over, and there's great manifestation of God's intervention on their behalf, that the Gentiles will then fall in line and permit all of those Jews to go back there willingly, pay their way, put at their disposal every kind of transportation as an offering to the Lord, because His holy kingdom will then be in effect and in operation in Palestine. And then, it is only then, it shall come to pass, Zechariah 12, 9 and 10. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. The same thought, you see. And after this, after they fail to destroy Jerusalem, and Jacob's trouble destroys most of them, I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. Now, some try to tell us that the Lord is already pouring out His Spirit upon the Jews now. But that's not true for me. You know that. It'll be after Jacob's trouble that the Lord will pour upon them His Spirit of grace and supplication. And then their eyes will be opened. Yes. And then they will mourn for the one whom they have pierced, as someone mourns for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him. But then you know the Lord will bless them. He will accept them as a sacrifice and begin His kingdom work with that people. the first family of the Lamb. Not the first family in God's arrangement, no. The little flock is really the Lord's first family. But they have a spiritual reward. They'll have the divine nature as co-rulers with Jesus. But Israel will be the first family of all the families of the earth who will be blessed under that kingdom arrangement. And I'm glad we are that we're so near to that time and see so many evidences of its near fulfillment.
That night we know something about what's going to happen now to the Jews. 3:10.